Happy holidays from This Week in Enterprise Tech. And this week we have Mr. Curtis Franklin and Mr. Brian Chee here. And we get into the breach details of Orion Network's management product, SolarWinds, what happened there and how organizations can actually protect themselves from third-party solutions. Plus, we may have heard the quote, big tech in the news lately. Well, some governments are targeting some of the companies out there, and the EU is getting into the game as well. Plus, we have a really great guest and a really great conversation today with Yusef Khan, managing partner with Ridge Ventures. And he's going to talk about some of the tech venture trends that are out there, what investors are looking for, and we just might dig into Yusef's experience as a CIO and what it takes to be a CIO in the current climate. Shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to making securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 423, recorded December 18th, 2020, reading between the lines. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Technology Powers X. Learn how technology and IT departments are reshaping their business through an original podcast from Dell Technologies. Search for Technology Powers X anywhere you listen to podcasts and download each episode today. And by TIBCO. TIBCO's connected intelligence platform simplifies the way you capture data, connect applications, and turn decisions into actions. Learn more about how TIBCO can unlock the value of your company's real-time data at TIBCO.com/podcast. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at 1/5 the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition with no fees for egress or API requests and no complex storage tiers. Start a free trial at wasabi.com and enter code ENTERPRISE. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise, but I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own enterprise security expert and journalist. He's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Happy holidays, Curtis. It's always amazing to see you on Twyatt. Now, what's keeping you busy these days, the honey-do list or the day job? Now, be careful which one you say.
Well, I'll have to admit that I've got a little bit of both going on. Day job is getting closer to being it done for the year, but still, interestingly enough, there's some huge security news. We'll be talking about that in a little while here on Twyatt. So day job is keeping me nice and busy, but strangely enough, my dear wife is also finding plenty of ways to keep me busy. So figuring out what I'm going to do with all my idle hours is not one of my problems.
You've handled that like a professional. Well done. Well done. Well, speaking of busy, we also have our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chee. Cheebert, it's about time you start the next chapter for the cheese. When does your trek start?
Yeah, who knows? We got an estimated timeline. It's going to be at least 2 weeks. We just had the appraisal on the house done. He says we'll have an appraisal report in about 2 weeks. And that is going to give us a much, much better and realistic view of what the house should be priced at. And then it's a matter of, you know, how fast does the new owner financing come through? It'll be really fast if it's cash. If there's financing involved, who knows? So sadly, it does not look like my wife and I will be joining Kurt and his lovely wife for the holidays in Orlando. It looks like we're going to be there in the new year. But in the meantime, I can close down some more projects here in the University of Hawaii and so forth. And it's going to be really interesting to see how big I can scale the artificial intelligence components for a campus-wide surveillance system.
Well, seeing that 2020 has been a complex year, it's also been pretty complex for IT departments and enterprise organizations as well, especially this past week. Now, we get into the breach details of Orion Networks management product from SolarWinds, what happened there, who's affected, and how organizations can protect themselves from third-party solutions. Plus, you may have heard the big quote, big tech in the news lately, and a lot of government agencies and are actually targeting companies out there. The EU has something to say about that because they are threatening to break up big tech companies if they repeatedly engage in anti-competitive behavior. We'll have a great discussion there. Plus, we're going to have a great conversation today. We have Yusef Khan. He's managing partner with Ridge Ventures. We're going to talk about the trends of tech ventures as well as what investors look for. And we'll dig into Yusef's experience as a CIO and talk about just what it takes to be a CIO in the current climate. But before we get to all that goodness, we have to jump into this week's blips. Now, we all know that hackers are constantly targeting people with hacks to browsers, whether they're the latest release of the browsers or the older versions. Hackers are targeting them all. Now, this past week, researchers unwrapped an ongoing campaign impacting popular web browsers that secretly injects malware-infested ads into search results to earn money via affiliate advertising. Going by the name AdRoszek, per the Microsoft 365 Defender research team that founded it, employs an expansive dynamic attacker infrastructure consisting of 150 unique domains, of each of which hosts an average of 17,300 unique URLs, which in turn hosts more than 15,300 individual malware samples. That's a lot. Now, the campaign, which impacts Microsoft Edge, Google Chrome, Yandex browser, and Mozilla Firefox browsers on Windows, aims to insert additional unauthorized ads on top of legitimate ads displayed on search engine results pages, leading users to click on these ads inadvertently. Now, researchers said that the persistent browser modifier malware had been observed since May this year, with 30,000 devices affected every day at its peak in August. Now, cybercriminals abusing affiliate programs is not new. Browser modifiers are some of the oldest types of threats. However, the fact that this campaign utilizes a piece of malware that affects multiple browsers indicates how this threat type continues to be increasingly sophisticated. Also, the malware maintains persistence and exfiltrates website credentials. It exposes affected devices to additional risks there. Now, once dropped and installed on targeted systems via drive-by downloads, AdRoszek proceeds to make multiple changes to browser settings and security controls to install malware and malicious add-ons that masquerade as genuine by repurposing the IDs of legitimate extensions. Now, although modern browsers have integrity checks to prevent tampering, the malware cleverly disables the feature. Now, it allows the attackers to circumvent security defenses and exploit the extensions to fetch extra scripts from remote servers. Now, these scripts then inject bogus advertisements and gain revenue by driving traffic to these fraudulent ad pages. What does this mean for you and your organization? Well, it means that you have to be judicious with the extensions that you allow on your devices, on your browsers. You use your enterprise security policies as well as regulate this more and ensure your browsers use only the ones approved by IT organizations. Sure, it's more work, but in the end, your organizations will thank you.
More than half of work from home parents say that their children have accessed their work accounts. A new 1Password survey on password use and online security in family life finds that 51% of parents who work from home say their children have accessed their work accounts, with 42% of the U.S. labor force working from home full-time. That's according to Stanford data. This is more than a little bit disconcerting. In addition, 14% of respondents say their children have access to their work devices, and many of these individuals shared stories of their children upending their work product by, for example, accidentally deleting a presentation. The good news in all this is that 40% say they are teaching children ages 3 to 4 about online security and using passwords. 13% say their kids were under 5 years old when they helped them create a password for their first online account. Now, nearly half of parents let children access devices with saved passwords on them, but 14% admit their kids have caused trouble by accessing an account using one of those saved passwords. One, for example, noted that their child got into their bank account and wired money to a random account. Oh, those kids. More than 75% of families share passwords by using a password manager, writing them down, or creating a spreadsheet. However, some don't change those passwords nearly as often as they should. The research indicates that more than a quarter of respondents still use the first password they created for an online account, and 5% say that a decade later, they're still using a password their mom and dad helped them create.
Well, Red Hat reset CentOS Linux and users are really angry. Red Hat, CentOS's Linux parent company, announced it was shifting focus from CentOS Linux to the rebuild of Red Hat Enterprise Linux, RHEL, to CentOS Stream. And that's basically going to track just ahead of the current RHEL release. So in other words, CentOS will no longer be a stable point distribution, but a rolling release Linux distribution. And I, for one, I'm a CentOS user. I'm not real pleased with that. Well, okay, so first you need to understand what's going on. A rolling release Linux is one that's constantly being updated. Examples of these include Arch Linux, Manjaro, and OpenSUSE Tumbleweed. Here, CentOS Stream will be RHEL's upstream, so development branch. So this may sound like CentOS is going to be RHEL's beta, but the CentOS folks deny this. In the CentOS FAQ, the company states, quote, CentOS Stream will be getting fixes and features ahead of RHEL. Generally speaking, we expect CentOS Stream to have fewer bugs and more runtime features than RHEL until those packages make it into the RHEL release. Oh, man. The bottom line is that the folks that can't or won't afford Red Hat Enterprise Linux have been relying upon CentOS as a stable platform for production services. This rolling update takes away a lot of the stability allure that attracted folks to it in the first place.
We've heard a lot about some of the organizations out there and the latest attacks. Now, most recently, the hackers behind the supply chain attack that compromised public and private organizations have devised a clever way to bypass multi-factor authentication systems protecting the networks they target. Now, during one of the intrusions recently, researchers noticed the hackers using a novel technique to bypass MFA protections provided by Duo. Now, after gaining administrative privileges on the infected network, the hackers used those unfettered rights to steal a Duo secret known as an A key from a server running Outlook web app, which enterprises use to provide account authentication for various network services. The hackers then used the A key to generate a cookie, so they had it ready when someone with the right username and password would need it when taking over an account. The researchers refer this to the state-sponsored hacker group as Dark Halo, really cool name. Now, Dark Halo's primary goal was obtaining emails of specific individuals inside think tanks and other organizations. Now, Dark Halo is a sophisticated threat actor that had no links to any public known threat actors to date. Now, this goes back to that zero trust model we talk about all the time, which ensures that access to one system doesn't guarantee access to another using things like micro-segmentation and re-auth loops. Now, it might be time that you audit your services for the new year to ensure you're not at risk as well.
Well, U.S. CERT reports that there have been 17,447 vulnerabilities recorded so far in 2020. The U.S. CERT vulnerability database has confirmed this 17,447 vulnerabilities, making it the fourth consecutive year with a record number of security flaws published. As of December 15th, officials reported 4,168 high-severity vulnerabilities, more than 10,700 medium-severity vulnerabilities, and more than 2,500 low-severity vulnerabilities so far this year. Now, as a comparison, in 2019, there were 17,306 flaws published, with over 4,000 of them high-severity, not quite 11,000 medium-severity, and just over 2,000 low-severity. This year saw a massive growth in crowdsourced security reporting. In its recent Priority One report, security firm BugCrowd reported that there's been a 50% increase in vulnerability submissions in the last 12 months compared with the year prior. These bug reports reflected a 65% increase in P1 submissions, those are the most critical vulnerabilities, and a 4% increase in the validity of submissions. HackerOne confirmed similar findings in its latest hacker-powered security report earlier this year. More than a third of the 180,000 bugs found via HackerOne were reported in the past year. New hacker signups on the platform increased 59%, and submitted bug reports grew by 28% in the months immediately following the start of the pandemic. The increased participation in crowdsourced security has certainly driven the number of bugs reported this year. However, it's worth noting the pandemic's effect on software development. Many organizations have had to rush applications through production, cutting down on quality assurance cycles and relying much more heavily on these third-party legacy and open-source code libraries and similar methods for finding the bugs that may exist there.
Oh, I hate this story, but, you know, Google has decided to kill Android Things, and Android Things is this IoT operating system, and it's going away in January. The latest dead Google project is Android Things, a version of Android meant for the Internet of Things. Google announced it had basically given up on the project as a general purpose IoT operating system in 2019, but now there's an official shutdown date thanks to the new FAQ page detailing the demise of the operating system. The Android Things dashboard, which is used for managing devices, will stop accepting new devices and projects in just 3 weeks, on January 5th, 2021. Developers will be able to continue updating existing deployments until January 5th, 2022, at which point Google says, quote, the console will be turned down completely and all project data will be permanently deleted, including build configuration and factory images, unquote. Now, considering how badly Google has spread the word about this option, I equate it like pulling a new James Bond movie after only out being out a week. With more and more IoT devices getting owned, having secure IoT OS options is finally gaining traction, but yet Google is throwing in the towel prematurely, if you ask me.
Now, I wanted to end our blips today with a story about the future, what the future holds us. It's bright. It's visionary, and it may just make all the sci-fi fans happy out there. Now, because folks, the scientists have achieved quantum teleportation. Now, if you're a Star Trek fan, you may have always dreamed about being actually beaming information from one place to another. Well, scientists led by Caltech at Fermilab, a U.S. Department of Energy Office of Science National Laboratory, announced the first ever successful demonstration of sustained long-range, high-fidelity quantum teleportation. Now, they successfully teleported qubits of photons over a fiber optic network at distances greater than 27 miles. That's right. Scientists say the achievement is a significant step towards realizing a viable quantum internet, which would revolutionize the world of computing and information technology. Now, once fully developed, quantum computers can solve important problems that would take a classical computer millions of years. Now, in quantum teleportation, a particle's quantum state is transferred to another pre-existing particle at another location. Now, this compares to teleportation of matter as well. The vision actually realized in the Star Trek shows. Now, as Dr. Sinclair explains, the scientific community has demonstrated matter-based quantum teleportation a long time ago, actually. In fact, people are now beginning to teleport quantum properties of larger and larger systems to see where quantum physics breaks down and more classical physics takes over. Now, quantum teleportation of matter properties is important for many quantum devices to work correctly, including quantum computers. Now, combining matter-based teleportation and other quantum network technologies at scale is one of the scientists' goals, so these issues become deeply connected in a network. Now, to this end, scientists will also work on converting quantum properties of light to matter and back again to bolster quantum internet capabilities. Now, get this. Not only does this breakthrough represent a bright future for networking, transmission of information based on quantum technology can actually guarantee to be secured based on fundamental laws of physics and quantum computers. While these breakthroughs have been significant in the march towards quantum computing, the ability of quantum teleport qubits across distances actually has proven to be quite complicated. However, the latest development have helped scientists develop a blueprint of what's to come. And let me tell you, friends, the future is quite bright. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Technology Powers X, an original podcast by Dell Technologies. Now, I got a sneak peek of Technology Power X. They have some really great content. I especially love the episode around the New Belgium Brewing Company, because I actually used to be a systems control engineer at Anheuser Brewery, where they actually use technology to power their business. And the episode talks about New Belgium and how they're evolving their business and using technology, and they actually gain insights into their customers and how thirsty they are. So cool. So another episode is also about theme parks and how they use sensors, massive amounts of data and software to make rides safer, more efficient, and fun. Another episode is about technology behind F1 racing and how the legendary McLaren racing team uses technology to make decisions about pitting, tire selection, and racing strategies at both trackside and at their data center. And one episode talks about vertical farming and how innovative new tech can change where food comes from, and how this may be the future of sustainably feeding 21st century populations. Technology Powers X is hosted by Danielle Applestone, a hardware engineer and entrepreneur. She does a fantastic job. To show you, here's a clip from the episode, The Beer You Love.
Today at New Belgium, the ancient craft of brewing has an indispensable 21st century ingredient, hyperconverged infrastructure. That infrastructure supports almost every aspect of planning, marketing, sales, and distribution.
Listen to the whole episode to learn all about the technology that powers beer at the New Belgium Brewing Company. Really great episode. Now, searching for Technology Powers X anywhere you listen to podcasts and download each episode today. That's Technology Powers X. Download it today. My thanks to Technology Powers X for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, news this week about a likely Russian-based threat actor infecting thousands of organizations with malware delivered via seemingly legitimate software updates of their Orion network management product from SolarWinds has stoked broad concerns on many, many fronts. Let's talk about them. Now, the concerns are particularly high because victims of the campaign reported include the U.S. Treasury Department, the Department of Homeland Security, the State Department, the Justice Department, and potentially entities from all five branches of the U.S. military. It's not good. Now, among others believed affected are numerous Fortune 500 companies. Now, SolarWinds accounts for 499 of them as its customers. Now, security vendor FireEye uncovered the SolarWinds campaign. Now, when investigating a breach of its own network recently, they resulted in several of its offensive hacking tools being stolen. Now, as expected, the targeted attack has once focused attention on the longstanding issue of supply chain and third-party security. It also has raised the alarm about the extent to which Russian advanced persistent threat actors and threat actors from other countries have infiltrated themselves into and lurking on U.S. critical infrastructure networks, ready to activate at any moment's notice. Sleepers. Now, in the industrial sector, hackers may be able to actually leverage the technology to gain access to business-critical industrial control systems and environments and move laterally across network systems to steal data on industrial processes, chemical formulas, and other sensitive data as well. Now, attackers can use their access to disrupt operations, cause production stoppages, or worse, safety and environmental instances. Now, I don't know if this reminds you of this, but it reminds me of Die Hard 4, where Live Free or Die Hard, you remember that? Where the battle for the fire sale attack? It sounds like that to me. Very scary stuff. Now, FireEye says its investigations show that threat actor, which is tracking as UNC2452, inserted a backdoor dubbed Sunburst into a digitally signed component of SolarWinds Orion network management product. Now, the malware was actually concealed in legitimate updates to Orion that SolarWinds distributed between March and June of this year. Now, SolarWinds says its investigation showed the updates were sent to about 33,000 of its approximate 300,000 customers worldwide. Now, some 18,000 of them actually downloaded the software, but it remains unclear how many of those organizations were actually targeted. Now, the vendor released a patch version of its affected software on Monday, and it said an additional hotfix could be released on December 15th. However, as of late afternoon of that day, the hotfix doesn't appear to be released. So far as it's not publicly, at least, attributed to attacks, any specific nation state sponsor. So there's no one in specific. But numerous media reports, however, have pinned the campaign on APT-29, or so-called Cozy Bear, a group thought to be associated with Russian intelligence. Now, what can organizations do to protect themselves? It's important to know here. Now, security researchers this week stressed that just because an organization might have received tainted updates doesn't mean it was targeted. Even so, the Department of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity, and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, has ordered all federal civilian agencies to forensically image system memory and analyze stored network traffic for IOCs. Now, it also has ordered all agencies to disconnect and power down their Orion instances, block traffic to and from hosts running any version of SolarWinds, and look for and remove threat actor-controlled accounts and persistent mechanisms. Now, this sounds like a lot of work to do to get rid of this. Let's talk about this with the co-host, because this is a pretty extensive breakthrough in the cyber threat here. Stuart, let's start with you. Before we get into the details of what happened, how we want to talk a little bit about how organizations protect themselves here. Now, is turning off services and analyzing network traffic really the only way to do it?
It's going to need to be, because the way a lot of these network management systems work is they actually have to have credentials into the devices. And in many cases, if you're having any sort of automation going, that means they have change capability. For the most part, they're using SNMP, Simple Network Management Protocol, and they're using read or write community strings. Now, if it's something simple, like if they're using someone's using a lot of older equipment where it's SNMP version 1, those are basically just passwords. And unfortunately, too many people still use public and write, the default factory passwords. Now, when you start getting into SNMP version 2, at least you start getting username and passwords and you have profiles. SNMP version 3 starts playing with certificates. So the issue is, you've got to start turning things off until you go and change those credentials. And changing credentials on management means you change credentials on a large collection of devices. Typically, when you start playing with network management, everybody has either similar within a group or across the board have the same management username and password. So, you kind of got to turn everything off, make the changes, and go back. One of the reasons why this whole thing has such a huge impact is there's a ginormous gap in the cost and effort between something like Orion, and then the next step up is things like Computer Associates, their systems, or EM7 from ScienceLogic. The price gap between those is massive. Since we have a venture capitalist on today's show, I'm probably going to ask him, hey, maybe it's time we start using money to go and encourage people to enter the market and have some middle ground. I'd love to see some progress in network management, both in security and availability of products.
Me too. Now, I have a cousin. He's a forensics expert at a company. He says, anytime you have these types of breaches, once the user has the account access, they can move laterally and then they hide themselves and, gain other access, other accounts. And so now you have to use, have to audit and use forensic evidence to find out if there's anybody been breached. Even if you close down accounts that you previously have known to be breached, they could have already infiltrated other accounts. So this is going to be very difficult for organizations to be able to tell what's going on. Curtis, I want to throw this to you. Now, we've seen many attacks where actually threat actors targeting third-party services, other services that are on people's networks that don't really have high-quality assurances or security as they're maybe an organization's main network components or infrastructure. What can organizations do to protect themselves, even from third parties here?
Well, that's a great question. And that's one of the things that a lot of organizations are talking about and are going to be talking about. It's interesting. I have been hearing about third-party risk assessment and third-party risk for a couple of years. And the noise around it has been growing. And here I'm going to make one of these fearless predictions for 2021. Third-party risk is going to be one of those phrases we hear about an awful lot in the coming year. So what can companies do? Well, one of the things is try to figure out exactly what their third-party risk is. And there are templates and tools to let them do that. There's an organization called the FAIR Institute that is all about third-party risk assessment and coming up with a quantitative model for what that risk is. These are some very bright people doing some very advanced work around putting real numbers, and by real numbers, I mean real dollars, to what the third-party risk is. So step one for any organization is figuring out just what their third-party exposure is. Once they know what it is, once they know where the areas of risk exist, then they can start doing something about it and start seeing where their efforts are going to have the greatest impact from a real dollars and cents point of view.
Agreed, agreed. Well, again, a complex subject because obviously, like you said, there's third-party applications, OEMs out there that we have to deal with. And you've also, you know, you could already have been breached in this case. And how do you deal with that? How do you go back and, you know, in history, audit your systems and figure out how to protect yourself? So there's a lot of complexity here.
There is, and it's important to note that this third-party risk, you know, we talk about things like the supply chain, which often means the software supply chain. People are, you know, talking about the dependencies they have now that everyone is using some sort of library, you know, free and open source library or app or small piece of code in their large enterprise application. So there's, you know, that piece of it. There's the physical supply chain. There are things like the applications you use, key anyone who's a SolarWinds customer. And then there's actually the downstream side. In other words, what kind of risk exists from the people who sell your product, who in many cases have access to some of your systems through your web-facing applications or other applications that allow them to do things like place orders and pay their bills. This is a complex 360-degree plus issue that now a lot of people in the C-suite and below are going to be spending a great deal of time on.
Right, right, right. Thanks, Kurt. Well, I think that does it for that one because we want to move on to the next one because, you know, we have to talk a little bit about big bad tech. That's right. The EU is targeting them, and we're going to see some movement there. Jibbert?
Well, this is interesting. You know, this has got a lot to do with GDPR and how the European Union is trying to take control and regulate technology. Now, the article is worth reading. You know, you really got to read it. Brussels is publishing drafts on all kinds of new tech regulations, and I'm not really sure what they're attempting to achieve other than they want control. Now, we know that breaking up of ultra large organizations is a double-edged sword. The example I'm going to use is the breakup of Ma Bell, the Bell system. It was massive. It basically was the entire telephone system for the greater United States and a large portion of the world. And through legislation, Ma Bell was broken up into baby bells. Now, the cool thing, the silver lining on that is that breakup created some new markets. And realistically, the modern internet a product of that breakup, because the competition was greater, because new markets were opened up, new technology started filtering in to fill those gaps and start providing things. You know, before the breakup, modems were regulated. I sold modems. It was hard to do, and you had to do all kinds of forms. So anyway, the European Digital Markets Act is basically saying they are going to say, if you have offenders that are going to keep offending their rules, they're going to try and force a breakup. Obviously, they can't touch the entity if they're in the United States, but if they're doing business in Europe, they're going to say, hey, your European business is going to have to be broken up into different business units. So this could be both good and bad. Now, realistically, this isn't a technology issue. This is policy. This is politics. And who better to prognosticate on that but Curtis? So, Kurt, what do you see? What do you think these guys are trying to do? Read between the lines for us, buddy.
Read between the lines. One of my favorite things, actually, to do is trying to read between the lines and hear what I think it is, you know, the EU has dramatically different ideas about things like privacy and the value of personal data than we do here in the U.S. Now, we believe, as a matter of principle, that personal data does have value. However, in practice, that tends to mean that it has value to the companies that collect it rather than to the individuals. In the EU, we're looking back at the individual. So I think what they are really trying to do is rebalance the relationship and the power between individuals and these large organizations. What's one way to do that? Make the large organizations smaller. And so I think that what we're going to see is a growing threat to force the companies to divest and break up, if for no other reason than it gives the EU a great bargaining chip with these companies. They say, if you don't pay more taxes, if you aren't friendlier to our local media companies, if you aren't more transparent with what you're doing to our citizens' data, we have no choice but to force you to break up. So it's going to be interesting to watch how this dance goes. I predict we're going to be talking about this same issue 4 years from now with perhaps some slightly different parameters on the what activity is going on this week.
Right. And, you know, I'd like to also point out one thing to our viewers. When you start having a corporate or an organization that's really, really large, the benefit, though, is that the organization naturally, hopefully, works together. I'm going to just do a what if about Microsoft. Microsoft is a large, large corporation, and I'm only doing this because, you know, Lou's on the show and he's a Microsoft person. So sorry, Lou. But the cool thing is even though it's really large and so forth and could be, quote, broken up by the EU, it has the capability of saying, product managers work together. So one of my favorite examples is the entire Office suite has hooks so they can have tools that work together. I literally use the APIs in the Office suite to be able to harvest information, and we built an entire touch tone and web registration system for the University of Hawaii on the Office API. That wouldn't have happened if Microsoft had been broken up. So this is one of those things that's going to be a double-edged sword. It could be good, it could be bad. In the case of Ma Bell, it was actually kind of good. And I actually had a comment from the head of Hawaiian Telephone. I had actually been barred from the building because I was one of the group that helped break the Hawaiian telephone monopoly in Hawaii. And we were playing golf and said, you know, that breakup was actually the best thing that ever happened. They posted record profits because all of a sudden it created all kinds of new markets. Will this happen in the case of what the EU is doing? Nobody knows. I don't know. My crystal ball is very foggy on this. I think this might be something we ought to bring up with our guest. And you know what? Why don't we do that? So, but first, I think Lou needs to go and thank one of our sponsors.
That's right. That's right. Thank you, Chibert. Next up, the guest. But before we get to that guest, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's TIBCO. Now, you know TIBCO. You've probably seen them on the Mercedes-AMG F1 racing car. No, I have. But do you know what they actually do? Well, TIBCO helps its customers unlock the value of their data in real time. Now, TIBCO isn't just their sponsor. Mercedes-AMG Petronas F1 has won 7 world championships while relying on an advanced digital foundation with digital analytics at its core. Now, they couldn't have done it without TIBCO's deep technical expertise in a lot of areas, like connecting disparate systems together, unifying data, predicting outcomes with advanced analytics, and providing clear results. Now, Panera Bread actually ran into a problem during the pandemic. They needed a platform to help connect all their data in a unified way. Now, TIBCO was able to help Panera actually diversify their business thanks to actually having a solid and flexible data management foundation. Now, Panera was able to successfully launch Panera Bread Grocery because of all that. Now, their actually technology is also life-saving as well. University of Chicago Medicine, CEA, Kristen Watts actually says, in real time, we're able to alert our rapid response team to which patients are likely to go into cardiac arrest. So far, we've successfully reduced the number of cardiac arrests in the hospital by an estimate of 15 to 20%. That's actually a lot. Now, this also made possible by TIBCO. Now, they confidently help you predict business outcomes with real-time data-driven intelligence. Now, TIBCO gives businesses what they need to be successful here. Now, data is the transformative energy of the modern enterprise. They definitely know that. And they help their customers unlock the value of their data. Now, real-time data to create competitive assets is really important. Now, top industry analysts, including Gartner and Forrester, believe that TIBCO's role in the digital economy is pervasive. Now, TIBCO solves tomorrow's impossible business problems by seamlessly connecting any application, device, or data source, intelligently unifying data for better access, trust, and control, and confidently predicting business outcomes with real-time data-driven intelligence. Now, let them help you connect the dots in ways you never thought possible. Fuel the modern enterprise through TIBCO Connected Intelligence. Learn more about TIBCO and how they can unlock the value of your company's data, real-time data, at TIBCO.com/podcast. That's TIBCO.com/podcast. TIBCO.com/podcast. And we thank TIBCO for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where you actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Yusuf Khan. He's a partner at Ridge Ventures. So great to have you on, Yusuf. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me. Long time listener, first time caller.
Fantastic, fantastic. Now, before we get to all the great topics, because we have a lot of them to talk about, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us on a short journey through tech and brought you to Ridge Ventures?
Yeah, totally. Well, first of all, I'm probably the accidental CIO turned unconventional VC. You've noticed by my slightly weird accent, I've a little bit of a citizen of the world, having been born in Pakistan, grew up in Egypt, Kenya, and the UK, still a royal subject of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, long may she live. I moved here to the US about 6 years ago. I have been a CIO of several companies, always been the very first CIO. And I like to joke, I'm not sure it's a good or a bad thing. I just know it's been my thing where I've always been. I think a part of it is like, how much damage can you really do? I mean, look, he wears a sweater vest to work every day. Come on. And so when companies have really required governance, management, and leadership of technology functions to help them scale, I've typically been very honored to receive that phone call. And, you know, having been a CIO kind of 5 times over, and basically been an interim CISO in 3 of those roles where I've kind of held ownership of cybersecurity. A large part of that was working with a number of startups at early stages, mainly because, as I kind of tend to explain, if CIOs want to innovate, they really want to be able to build creative solutions. And hiring software engineers in the Bay Area, if you are a CIO, it's talent acquisition, the talent wars are real. And so I would rather partner with startups at early stages, either as a first customer for several companies or being able to provide feedback and provide guidance. And as a result of that, formed a relationship with a number of VCs who had reached out to me for diligence or feedback or advice, and sometimes. And Ridge was one of those where I've known the firm and the team for best part of a couple of years, being part of their CIO council. And in my last role as a CIO, as my fifth role, I kind of got to the notion of understanding that perhaps, you know, where I really want to focus my effort and where my passion is to work with early stage companies. And Ridge was the right firm for me. And it was the right team and it was the right time. And so that's I decided to make the jump, and very happy to be here.
Fantastic. Now, I do want to get into the CIO job because it is a dark art. We'll get to that. I definitely want to talk a little about that. But I want to start with the current period. Now, the pandemic period has moved the market in many different directions. Where do you see changes? Where are you seeing, maybe gaps due to the current term?
Yeah, so I think one of the key things, and I was a CIO during the pandemic, and then of course had made the shift. So I've probably got the vantage point from both angles. And I speak to a number of my CIO friends. I jokingly call it group therapy. So I tend to hear a lot of interesting feedback. I think a couple of things. I think one is, many of us probably were well prepared in some cases, just because of adoption and deployment of cloud solutions and being able to actually enable distributed workforces pretty rapidly. I think the places that we weren't prepared was to or required more effort were things around enablement of our employee bases to be able to make sure that we use the tools accordingly. I think data was a problem for a number of companies. The instrumentation and the visualization to be able to make decisions, which were typically done in a much more in a physical presence. I think security was a bit of a wake-up call, which happy to talk a little bit more about. Really like what Curtis said earlier on. I agree with a large part of that. So those things I've typically seen and observed. Some of that will stay, but I think there's enough data points which basically talk to a hybrid and, candidly speaking, some practices not continuing. So that's what I'm typically hearing from my CIO community, but also looking at startups who are operating in this space.
Yeah, that's a good segue because I think obviously Ridge Venture is a venture capital company. Yeah. What types of things are you folks looking for now? Obviously, this has changed probably over the last year or so. What gaps are you looking for now in companies and startups and areas like that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think with early stage investing, we typically invest in late seed, Series A companies. Typically, will send check sizes of between 2 and say 7 million, and we'll focus on enterprise B2B. And one thing to remember is, especially in the early stage, company building takes time and effort. So we've actually seen a tremendous amount of inbound in talking to companies who are or building around a number of different areas. I can talk to some of those. I think one of the things I'm continuously seeing is that data security and privacy and compliance management seems to be a running theme. I think there's going to be more data enforcement and more data regulation. That it's not just going to come from the EU. I think that's happening globally. And I think countries have recognized that the data is a core asset, which is going to be helping drive economies. And I think that's a key piece. The move towards more digital platforms, both from a customer experience standpoint and an infrastructure standpoint, and being able to tool for those, much bigger focus there. So I'm seeing a definite number of solutions in, say, the DevOps space. And I'm a believer that microservices is definitively a revolution, and that Kubernetes is going to be taking a much bigger mind share for engineering teams than ever before. So we tend to see and a lot of focus in some of these areas quite a bit. I can say that there's a lot of focus on vertical SaaS. There are a number of different sectors, whether it's construction, facilities management, agriculture, and others, where software is going to transform those industries. And perhaps this was a wake-up call this past year for a large part of those to be able to adopt to those. And I think that, for me, has been pretty definitive. But we focus very heavily on enterprise B2B, work very well with repeat founders. And so we think about pretty, in quite general terms. This is about investing in the right team who think about big problems in big markets and, of course, solving big problems. And so, we get excited by that.
Right. Obviously, it's interesting that you mentioned compliance because obviously it's not the most sexy area in tech, but I definitely can tell you there's definitely some gaps there.
I think I'm Nerdville all day, every day. Let's go. Yeah, totally. sorry to interrupt, Lou, but no, it's not optional. This is the biggest thing. When I was CIO of a few companies, when you were looking to basically make changes, in one situation, a company's gone public, you're going to be defining changing processes. And enablement of that change and being able to walk people through takes time and effort, and it's not optional. And the other thing, that forcing function for this, is there's more data being ingested than ever before. There's more software being built than ever before. All of this needs to be secured. all of this is storing customer data. It's basically making sure that it has to be done so in from a compliant fashion from it, in terms of regulations which are local and regional. And then they need to be secured. And all of the things that go in from a security standpoint is a huge overhead. And it needs to be automated, and it needs to be, you know, frictionless from a user experience standpoint. So I see that as a big focus area.
Right, right. I agree. I actually have a good friend, Craig Unger. He started Hyperproof, which is actually a compliance automated solution. Really great topic. I know, again, it's not a sexy topic to talk about, but like you said, all organizations have to start considering it more. You know, having these tools at bay will definitely help them along the way. Well, when we come back, we have a lot more to talk about here, but I do want to get to our next sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Wasabi is the perfect solution for managed service providers to sell because they earn more while charging less. Now, it's also 80% cheaper than Amazon S3 and significantly cheaper than on-premise storage. Now, typically, you can store data in Wasabi's cloud for less than just the annual cost of the maintenance fees on the same amount of on-prem storage. Now, Wasabi's disruptive price performance model makes buying cloud storage a natural addition. Now, there are two ways to pay. You can pay as you go, or you can pay one time with reserved capacity storage. Now, Wasabi's reserved capacity storage makes buying cloud storage a natural addition to your on-premise storage. Now, if you think about buying more hardware storage, compare the price against 5 years of reserved capacity storage. Now, you can purchase cloud storage in 1, 3, or 5 year increments and achieve greater discounts for term and capacity. With Wasabi, security is often even greater than on-premise storage, and it provides 11 nines of durability. That means on average, you lose one file every 649,000 years. So basically, you're not going to lose a file. Now, hosted in premier tier 4 data center facilities that are highly secure, fully redundant, Wasabi is secure by default, and all data stored in Wasabi Cloud is always encrypted at rest, even if the requesting party doesn't specify encryption. Now, Wasabi also follows industry best security models and design practices. They have access control mechanisms such as bucket policies and access control lists that can be used to selectively grant permissions to the users and when you want to grant them permissions. Now, your data will be immutable, actually prevent data from being erased or altered, and you'll be protected both from hackers, malware, and even yourself. Wasabi also has active integrity checking where all objects stored are checked for integrity every 90 days. They're also compliant with HIPAA, FINRA, and CGIS compliance. Wasabi is not just highly secure, disruptive technology that's turning the industry on its ear. It's storage that's 80% cheaper and up to 6 times the speed of the industry leader. Calculate the savings for yourself and start a free trial of storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com. Click the free trial link and enter the code ENTERPRISE. Join the movement. Migrate your data to the cloud with confidence. Go to wasabi.com and make sure you use the offer code ENTERPRISE. And we thank Wasabi for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Yusuf Khan. He's a partner with Ridge Ventures. A lot of stuff to talk about here. And, of course, we have to get into that CIO role and the CISO role. You know, but I want to bring my co-host back in. I want to start with Curtis. Curtis, obviously, talk with a lot of CISOs, a lot of CIOs out there. What do you got to ask?
Well, I think it's fascinating. You know, a decade ago, we were talking about the changing role of the CIO. And one of the things I'm curious about, you know, when you're out there in the market, do you genuinely see that issues of risk and security are making their way up into enterprise management, into the boardrooms and the C-suites? Or is this more of that fable, the mythology of the industry, where we love to talk about it, but in reality, the people with C in their title want someone else to do the worrying for them?
So it's definitely not a fable. I think it's I've consistently over the last few years, I've seen, having presented to you know, boards of companies, having worked with board members, it is now becoming much more central and a much bigger agenda item, you know. So that's, it's important to just say that. And for me, that's pretty definitive. And the reason for that is, if you think about over the last several years, as the hacks in major brands have happened, those have really entered into the mainstream. They're not in the industry press. They are actually in the mainstream press, and therefore that catches the attention and it affects the data for consumers, board members who have gone to some of these retail brands or have been affected personally by some of this. That's one. The second is the threat vectors have become much more complex and sophisticated, and as a result of that, they capture much more mind share. And I think that's important. If I think about the conversations that I sort of tend to see and why also kind of what's being done is part of the challenge with all of this is that companies do feel vulnerable. If the last week, this week's news have said anything, it's a big wake-up call. And I think it's real. And the harsh reality is that the number of cybersecurity professionals that are out there who are certified, who are trained, is actually – you know, it's, I would estimate it's probably no more than 20 to 30,000 tops, is my guess. And, you know, there's probably more, you know, and you've got to be able to take the fact that, you know, people aren't trained very well to be able to help drive and improve the security posture of enterprises. As a result, CIOs, and that's why I held oversight around cybersecurity in three companies, because I thought it was good citizenship, but it was not, and it was the right thing to do. But I fundamentally believe that security is everyone's problem. I don't believe it's just the CISO's role and their org. We should not be just pointing the finger. You know, phishing is the number one threat vector for the last 3 years in any CISO, CIO survey that you think about. That comes down to humans clicking on something, which will cause a breach. And has consequences across the entire company. So I would say that board members are definitely becoming a lot more attuned to saying what is the risk profile and what are the resources that company needs. I definitely believe the executive teams understand much more that this is a key part of how they need to operate. And candidly speaking, customers are driving this. I think customers, both on the consumer brands but also on the enterprise brands, will be saying, talk to us about how, demonstrate to us that you care about security. Walk us through what your roadmap looks like. So one of the things that I did, I was an employee of an early stage company after I left one CIO gig. And I, you know, one of the discussions that we basically had was, do we want to build a true enterprise company? And if we do, we should be enterprise ready. And part of that basically means we need to have a really good security infrastructure and a foundation in place. Houses are built on good foundations. And I think if you want to be able to make sure that that house stands the test of time, make sure that foundation is solid. And so that starts at the top. Now, is it fair to say that some people are way behind? Probably. But if this week's news isn't a wake-up call, I actually don't know what is. I would be very, very surprised. And so I think I have seen, and my data point is not just the Bay Area. I've worked with companies outside. I see this as a regular part of conversation, people trying to solve and how to basically figure that. So.
Okay, you did a great job of segueing into the next question I wanted to ask, and I appreciate that. But let's get to that, which is the issue of the skills gap.
Yep.
You know, the fact that there is a security skills gap is no news to anyone. But we see in many cases people basically trying to automate their way around that skills gap, bring in more complex enterprise security management systems, more complex SIEMs, more complex everything, and give those tools more dramatic access to their application delivery network, their entire infrastructure. So do you see, both in the prospective investments that you're making and in the customers, an increasing push to this automating our way around the problem? Or do you think that people are recognizing that there might be some limits to that and, you know, searching for those human responses and human solutions rather than just a technological one?
Well, I'd say three key things. Number one is, I think if this year and has taught us anything, I think security has to be completely rethought for enterprises. So my one big prediction, you've made a big prediction. So my big prediction for next year is that security will be fundamentally rethought across multiple companies. And I think there are strategy sessions and panic rooms and group therapy sessions happening as we speak. And people are rethinking this from a different vantage point. One of the reasons for that is, as companies have gone into a distributed workforce, fundamentally being able to actually authenticate and manage their network and manage their infrastructure. Well, I'm calling you from, you know, Northern California, but I may also then log in if my credentials have been breached, heaven forbid, see a login from another geography. Is that valid or not? Well, no one could tell because everybody's working from home and people may be traveling. If you increase that at scale, that's a major problem for visibility, observability, or otherwise. And that basically means that you've got much more work to do. And that, as a result, with the level of threat vectors becoming more complex, the level of data that companies are ingesting about the security threats, I think what's going to happen is that companies want more automation, but I think they want more prescriptiveness. So my second prediction is that there's probably going to be a much bigger drive towards more automate, more predictive systems, which are driving more prescriptive techniques. And the reason for that is very simple. You have to have a level of prioritization which goes into the security stack when you want to be able to resolve issues. It is, you don't have the manpower for it. You don't have the complete knowledge for it. You still have to do a lot of inspection and investigation to do that, and remediation. It takes time. And so the systems that are able to drive effort and guide security teams to be able to resolve those issues are the ones that are going to basically win. I think that's going to be driven through automation. I think some of it's going to be driven through AI techniques, which are much more statistical in nature, being able to drive reduce false positives, for example. And other ones are going to be probably much more focused towards areas where people haven't spent enough time, and they're going to be looking for more automated solutions to be able to deploy, whether it's IoT solutions or industrial manufacturing systems. And I think that has to be driven through more automated solutions. So yes, I think I also do think that there's been a little bit of a fatigue that's going to kick in, that there has been a ton of investment that's gone into security infrastructure in a number of companies. I think letting that absorb, connecting those up, making sure that they are talking to each other, that they're well, you know, that is a cohesive operation, hasn't been done. So I do believe that the human piece to it will be architectural driven, and that I think output will be machine and automation driven.
Yusuf, we've been talking a lot, and a lot of the references that we're making and so forth seem to be very U.S.-centric. Mm-hmm. But we're not the whole world, and you've got some great views at the international marketplace. So what I'm going to do is ask you to look into your international crystal ball and say, what kinds of things are we going to see globally as we start hopefully coming out of this pandemic?
Yes. So I think on the global scale, a couple of things are, and I speak with CIOs and CISOs outside of the U.S., on a relatively regular basis, because, I do want to understand what's kind of happening. I think one thing to just caveat that is there's a lot more connectedness. So within both industries and companies. And so there isn't as much lag as I've basically seen for technology trends to affect different geographies. And I think that's important to be able to sort of point out. And that's why you are seeing a lot of investment both in the European continent by, you know, US VC firms who would never have basically been there, as well as, you know, European-based companies working in the U.S. So I would say a couple of things. I think data security and compliance is going to be an issue. I think that there is going to be more data enforcement that's kind of happening. That is pretty definitive. I do think that AI maturity is starting to basically happen. I think there's probably a much bigger focus. What I hear, there's a much greater adoption of AI-based solutions, especially in things like the financial services sector in, say, Europe, which is, I would consider, be much more mature than what I would see in the U.S. So there's much more driven towards AI deployments that are basically happening there in probably much a much bigger way. I see that as a pretty regular piece. Look, I think there's one thing to be said about kind of what the world that we live in from an online in what we've learned over the course of the year, especially with COVID. And I think that is that basically, how do you drive productivity in a concerted, non-exhaustive manner across enterprises? And tools and focus and how you're able to automate, you know, there's a reason why there's been this drive toward democratization of solutions, low code, no code, because people want to have a little bit more control in terms of being able to how they're driving their work. They can't speak to people, and some of them don't. I mean, people have been working from home for many, many years, way before COVID hurt. We just woke up to the fact that actually it's very, very possible and it's very standard, right? And so I think driving productivity is going to be a pretty much definitive focus. So that basically means that enablement of solutions. If companies are buying more SaaS than they've done before, if they are building more technology than they've done before, you hear the notion about every company becoming a tech company. If they're hiring more technical people, I think one of the things I would say is there's probably going to be a much bigger focus for enablement across companies than you would normally see. So I think that would be a much bigger focus of investment in companies as well.
Well, I'd like to do a fast follow-up. About a decade ago, I did a shootout, a product comparison review with InfoWorld Magazine on security event management, where one of the scenarios is, gee, someone just did a card key swipe at the local, but someone also did a VPN from Germany. SEM died as a product marketplace, product vertical, not too terribly long ago. Is COVID going to bring it back? Is this something that we might start seeing someday again?
No, I don't think so. I think the real solution-centric approach to that is probably something much more data-driven, which I think it will be kind of next-generation SIEM to a certain extent. But I think that's going to combine with other data sources and probably more algorithmic in terms of solutions. And I think it'll be probably much more tightly enforced. If I think about a couple of years ago, the number of integrations that are happening with a number of the key manufacturers like Palo Alto Networks, say, integrating with Okta, think about identity. If I think about workloads going into AWS and how you kind of need to be able to decipher to be able to make sure that, you know, if you think about the number of services that are going to cloud platforms like Microsoft Azure and AWS and others, being able to make sure that you can say about identity and to be able to make sure that people have the access that they need and that the right people have access, that is a major problem. And it's not going to be solved by a SIEM. I think there's going to be much more. So I do think that application security, identity, compliance, all of these things are kind of intertwined. And I think that's going to be a big focus. But going back to your original point, I do think it's going to be a much more data-driven. I think there's going to be different approaches towards solving that problem versus a SIEM.
Thanks again, Youssef. All good things must come to an end. Thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time, but we did want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can go to learn more about Ridge Ventures and how they can, you know, maybe see some of your ventures.
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is ridge.vc. Feel free to follow me at YA Khan and connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm more than happy to help out both the founder in their enterprise journey and would love to hear more.
Again, well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another out of the best thing enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this podcast possible. It's a team effort, and we have the best team in the industry, starting with our co-host and our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you and all your work?
Well, I'm going to be continuing to write for Dark Reading, and especially The Edge of Dark Reading. Have a number of things coming up here at the end of the year. Got a couple of, slideshow sorts of things where we look at different products. I've got one on free and open source security tools for your cloud infrastructure. So some good stuff coming up. Some new adventures in the new year. Looking forward to telling the Twyatt Riot about those. And with any luck at all, time to get in some good naps and a little bit of feet up as we slide through the socially distanced end of the year and into what will hopefully be a much better year to come.
Thanks, Curtis. I need a nap as well. Well, we also have to thank Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? So where can people find you and all of your work online?
Oh, on Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. Or drop me an email. I'm chibert@twit.tv. Or, you know, dropping a line to twyatt@twit.tv will hit all the hosts. And we'd love to hear your ideas for shows. We'd love to hear your suggestions for guests. And we'd love to hear your opinion. You know, we get all kinds of interesting opinions from all over the world. We're actually sharing a few of those with our guest. We've had comments from Africa, all over Europe. We actually had one quick comment from a download viewer at McMurdo Sound in Antarctica. Kind of cool. But we want to hear from you. Right now, I am sitting in a very, very empty house. The renovations are almost done. And we just had our appraisal done. And we're going to start moving forward on putting the house in the market so that we can start moving literally from one end of the country to another. So Hawaii to Florida. So hopefully in the new year, I will be Curtis Franklin's neighbor. Take care, everybody, and I hope everybody has a great holiday season.
Thank you, guys. Thank you guys for being here. Well, we also have to thank you as well. You are the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise and IT news goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your IT news. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, the show notes, the guest information, the Ghost Coast information, and the links of the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos there, you'll get those helpful and subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, the video version of your choice, and listen in on any one of your devices, whether it's on the go or at home. And any one of your podcatcher applications as well. Subscribe and listen. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise news as well as support the show. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family members, even your coworkers with the gift of Twiat, because we talk about some fun tech topics here on the show, and I can guarantee they will find them interesting as well. So definitely give the gift of Twiat. Now, after you subscribe, and you're available 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on Fridays. We do this show live.twit.tv. You can come see how the pizza's made, the behind the scenes, all the fun we have here on Twit. And you can check that out live.twit.tv. And now, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room as well, because we have a great set of characters there each and every week. Has some great discussions, get some great questions. Really a live discussion during the show. So check that out at irc.twit.tv. Come join the discussion and actually be part of the show. Now, if you can't be part of the live show and you still want to be part of the amazing community, we still have a great website out there that has 24/7 discussion, whether it's hosts or co-hosts. It's a lot of the Twit family that's out there. They have a lot of discussions 24/7. That's twit.community. Check it out. It's a really great website to continue the discussion 24/7. Come join the community at twit.community. Now remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/Lumam. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. Of course, I have some great conversations with people like you, our loyal listeners. But more importantly, I also post some of my work week tidbits out there from Microsoft. Now, if you want to check out what I do at Microsoft, you go to developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post all the latest and greatest ways that you can customize your Office solutions using Office APIs and add-ins to really make it more productive for you and your organizations. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we couldn't do this show without their support. So thank you for all their support. Of course, I want to thank all the engineers and staff at Twit. And, of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time. Cheebert, he's not only our co-host in crime, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the show bookings and the plannings for the show, so we really couldn't do the show without him. Thank you, Cheebert, again, for all your support on Twit. Now, before we sign out, I do want to thank our editor behind the scenes who makes us look good, Victor. Thank you so much for all your support this year and all the great work that you've done. But more importantly, too, as well, right now we have Mr. Ant Pruitt. He is our TD for today, but also he's an amazing personality and technologist that's on Twit. He has some great shows out there, Twit on Twit. Ant, what's coming up in the latest week, and what type of content do you have out there right now?
Well, I had a really good time doing some image critiques on this week's Hands-On Photography. Hop on over there, check that out, and check out my insights. And actually, you can help out some of the community members there as well yourself. So, yeah, Hands-On Photography.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ant. And definitely check out the Best Of show that's coming up in the coming weeks of all of our great Twit shows that we do on the Twit Network. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twit.
Want more Twit? Check out Tech News Weekly, twit.tv/TNW. Tech News Weekly is a show where Jason Howell and I bring the latest and greatest interviews to you from the people making and breaking the tech news. twit.tv/TNW.